just like last time, there's two exercises you're doing today, and also just like last time, they don't take the same amount of time. The one that doesn't only takes a couple minutes, and you, I don't care whether you start with it or do it second, is the pH testing. There's two identical trays over here. It doesn't matter which one you use, but that's just a matter of using pH strips. So easy, I'm not even going to talk about it. Just don't forget to do it. The one that takes longer is testing for the presence or absence of specific molecules, which is a useful thing. We work with solutions in chemistry and biology, and sometimes it's useful to know what's in those solutions. Well, there's all kinds of different tests we can perform, but in this course, we're focusing on three. Do you remember the three without looking? The names of the tests I'm talking about. Benedict's is one. IKI and the Biuret test. Yes, those are the three tests you're going to learn to use today. And each one, of course, tests for something different. What does Benedict's test for? Monosaccharides, exactly. We haven't really talked much about monosaccharides yet, but we will next lecture, as soon as you're done with today's test. Monosaccharides are simple sugars. Simple because it's possible to take multiple monosaccharides and hook them together to make more complex sugars. Polysaccharides are made up of many monosaccharides. But a monosaccharide is a molecule in its own right when it's just not connected to anything else. That's what Benedict's tests for. What about the IKI test? Starch. Well, speaking of polysaccharides, starch is a polysaccharide. It's many glucoses hooked together. So it's not glucose, even though it's made out of glucose. It's starch. All right. And by the by, in case you care or wonder, IKI is a chemical formula. It's not really an acronym. I mean, it is an acronym, but it's also a chemical formula. It stands for iodine potassium iodide. So that's the stuff that's in the reagent, the solution that you use to perform the test and to which you add some unknown substance to test it. And then the Biuret test tests for what? Proteins, exactly. Well, the IKI test and the Biuret test are pretty straightforward. So other than what I've already told you, I'm not going to mention that. I'll just let you follow the instructions on that. All three tests, though, work as tests because in the presence of the specific thing that the test tests for, there is some sort of noticeable change, visible change, specifically a color change of some sort. That's why you know that whatever you're testing for is there. And if you don't see the color change, then it's not there. So every test is a yes or no result, basically. Yes, it does contain that, or no, it doesn't. But also, there's at least somewhat of a qualitative assessment you can make as to how much is there. Qualitative is not numerical. Quantitative is numerical, so you're not putting any numbers to the concentration or anything. But you can tell, compared to other positive results, whether something has more or less than that because of how much color change there is. That's a qualitative assessment. So the only one of the three that I want to talk a little bit more about is the Benedict's test. And I'll be talking a little bit about what's on page 48, eventually. But first, I need to give you a couple definitions. And this is one of the main reasons I want to explain this. Not only because it's confusing when you first learn these terms, it's at least linguistically confusing, but also because we're going to talk much more about what I'm going to define in Unit 3, which is the probably the hardest unit for most people. So I'm talking about talking much more about it upstairs. So the stuff that you're learning today for Benedict's reagent will revisit quite a bit. Anyway, I want to define redox. And that is a portmanteau, which is a word that combines two words into one, like spork, for instance. But redox is short for reduction and oxidation. And it's not only easier to say redox than it is to say reduction oxidation, but it's kind of good that they used a portmanteau to combine the two, because they always go hand in hand, meaning that you're never going to have reduction only or oxidation only. If one of them happens, then the other also happens, which will make sense as soon as I define it if you don't already know the definition. Here comes the confusing part, though, linguistically. In everyday language, when we talk about something being reduced, you think that there's a decrease, right? And so there's a removal of something is what you kind of expect, like a reduction in weight. You lose mass, so you exert less weight. But for redox, reduction refers to the gain of an electron, not the loss. Oxidation is just the opposite. Oxidation is the loss of an electron. Okay, now the reason that this still makes sense, even though it seems backwards, is that, as you have already learned, an electron is a negatively charged particle, right? So if you gain an electron, your overall charge will be numerically reduced. It'll go down in value, right? More negative, in other words. So think of it that way to make sense of which one is which. Reduction is gain of electron. Oxidation is loss. Now, if that's not already confusing, then there's even more confusion in the words, in the terminology used, because in any redox reaction, something, by definition of being a redox, something has to be reduced and something else has to be oxidized. All right? This is why they go hand in hand, by the way, because you can't, an electron doesn't just pop into existence or cease to exist, right? The only way something can gain an electron is if something else lost it. That's why you always have both and not just one of these processes happening. But here's the additional confusion. In a redox reaction, the thing or species or participant in the reaction, whatever word you want to use, the thing that is becoming reduced, which by definition means the thing that is receiving an electron, is called the oxidizing agent. Because by becoming reduced, that thing is causing something else to be oxidized by losing its electron and transferring it to the thing that's being reduced. Okay? The thing that is becoming reduced is called the oxidizing agent because it oxidizes something else by becoming reduced itself. And exactly the converse is true as well. In other words, the thing that is becoming oxidized by being stripped of an electron is therefore called the reducing agent because that electron is going to go to it and reduce it. Yeah. Well, reagent simply means a reactant. And so Benedict's reagent is the solution before you add your unknown to it. It's this blue stuff. And I'll talk more about that in a second. So does all this make sense linguistically that I've said? Okay. Now, redox reactions we'll discuss much more in detail, as I said, in Unit 3, but hopefully it's clear to you just from the definition that if you're talking about ionization of something, that's a redox reaction, right? because ionization is either gain or loss of electrons. Now, remember where the metals are. They're everything except this triangle up in the upper right-hand corner, right? These are all metals. This first group, you don't have to know this name, but they're called the alkali metals. The second group is the alkaline earth metals. And both of those form, if they're going to become ions, they always do so the same way. Everything in group one, including sodium that we used as an example, if it becomes an ion, it's going to become an ion by losing exactly one electron and become, therefore, a positive one ion. Everything in group 2 is going to lose 2 electrons to become a positive 2 ion. There aren't any exceptions. Okay, those are some of the metals. But then there are the metals in this block right here between these two groups of tall groups. All of these in here are collectively called the transition metals. And many of those metals in that transition block can form ions more than one way. So there are multiple different versions of ions of some of those metals, including the one we care about today, which is copper. Benedict's reagent, the blue stuff you're going to be working with today, is really just a solution of water with copper ions in it. But copper can form two different kinds of ions. Copper's right here in this transition block. There are such things as copper 1 ions, as they're called, but that's symbolized as Cu with a 1 plus superscript. There are also, though, copper 2 ions, which is Cu with a 2 plus superscript. Now, how does a copper atom become a copper 2 ion? How? By what? More specifically, how does it become a copper 2 ion? By losing exactly 2 electrons. It's not just losing electrons, it's losing 2 electrons. The number matters, right? Because if it loses only 1, it would become a copper 1 ion instead. Well, what makes Benedict's reagent, or Benedict's solution, blue in appearance to us is that it's all of the ions in it are copper 2 ions, and copper 2 ions look to us in solution blue. And there are quadrillions and quadrillions of those copper 2 ions, even in a tiny volume of Benedict's solution. All right. Now we can look at page 48, and keep in mind that what we're testing for with Benedict's test is the presence of monosaccharides. Monosaccharide is not a specific chemical, right? It's a category. There are many, many monosaccharides. You built one with your kits, glucose, the most important one in biology, but it's just one of many, many monosaccharides. As we'll see once we get into surveying the macromolecules in Unit 2, monosaccharides, no matter what they are, if they are in the linear form as opposed to the ringed form, the thing that you built for glucose was the linear form. It didn't wrap back on itself. Anyway, any monosaccharide in the linear form has somewhere in its structure a carbon double bonded with an oxygen, which you know as what kind of functional group? Right. A monosaccharide has a carbonyl group. And this is why monosaccharides as a category are called reducing sugars. Now think back to what I gave you as definitions. The reducing agent is called that for what reason? What is the reducing agent in a redox reaction? No. The reducing agent. The reducing agent is not removing an electron. the reducing agent is being stripped of an electron, which means it is becoming oxidized. It's called a reducing agent because it's reducing something else by giving it that electron. Is that clear? Monosaccharides are reducing sugars because they're able fairly easily to give up an electron, which means the sugar itself, the reducing sugar, is going to become oxidized, but it's going to reduce whatever it gives the electron to. Okay? That's why they're called reducing sugars. Well, the source of the electron, the reason that sugars are able to do this, is one of the electrons in the four that make up the double bond between the carbon and the oxygen in the carbonyl group of that monosaccharide. As you can see on that page I talked about. Here's a glucose structural formula. Any other monosaccharide would have a carbonyl in it somewhere as well. But the point is, the carbonyl group has that double bond between C and O. That's really four overall electrons, right? But one of them can easily be stripped. And therefore, the sugar gets oxidized. But what gets reduced, in the case of the Benedict's test, is one of those copper ions. Of the trillions of copper two ions that are in there, one monosaccharide will reduce one of those copper ion, copper two ions. That means one of those copper two ions will take on an additional electron. What does that change copper two into? Copper one, right? It's only positively one charged now because it has an additional negative. But notice what happened to its charge. It went from 2 numerically to 1. That's a reduction numerically by receiving that electron. Okay? Now, if you were to make a solution consisting of only copper 1 ions, it wouldn't be blue at all. It would be brick red. Kind of an orangish red, just the color of most clay bricks. That's if all of the ions were copper one. Well, when you do a test and you do have some monosaccharides present, then some, but maybe not all, of those copper two ions get reduced. And if you have a combination of copper two and copper one, then it's not blue or brick red, but somewhere in between. It can be yellow, green, all kinds of different colors in between. That's what I was talking about when I was saying you could compare two positive tests and know which one has relatively more monosaccharides, the one that gets closer to brick red. Even though you're not putting any numbers to it, it's not quantitative. You can qualitatively tell. All right, any questions on all of that background? Yeah. If I say it, then you have to know it. Whether I'll ask about it, you just never know that. But if it's on a recording, it's fair game, yes. Now, a couple more things to say before I let you loose on it. One, before I forget, is that there's nothing that's likely to kill you today, but you should be wearing goggles because you're working with liquids and heat. But your ultimate goal, even though you don't start with it, of course, is to try to figure out what are in your unknown solutions. You need to do some background work, though, before you can conduct the tests to figure that out. So for each of the three types of tests, following the instructions in the manual, you need to do some preliminary tests. Specifically, for each of the three tests, you need to perform a test on something that you know should be negative because it does not contain whatever the test tests for. So for Benedict's, for instance, you would pick something that you know does not have any monosaccharides in it. Even though you know it doesn't, test it anyway to see what it looks like. It's important to see what a true negative looks like for each of these tests. And then also pick something that you know has the thing that that test detects, so that you can see a true positive. And then you can pick just anything else. When I say pick, I'm talking about from your white baskets. So do a true negative, a true positive, and anything else, just as a preliminary to see how the test works. Do that for all three tests. Once you're done with that, then you can proceed to an unknown. Now listen carefully on this. Notice that there are 12 bottles here because there's 4 A's, 4 B's, and 4 C's. But each of the A's is different. Each of the B's is different. Each of the C's is different. Therefore, choose one A, one B, and one C. Doesn't matter which one you choose, but write down which number you have. Because you're eventually going to tell me what your, not guesses, but deductions are as to what the contents of those solutions are based on tests. Okay, so write down which bottle you have. For each of the unknowns, so you'll have 3 unknowns, an A, a B, and a C. Each one you need to subject to all 3 different tests. In other words, you need to test A for monosaccharides, for starch, and for proteins. And the same for B and C. So you're going to do 9 tests on these overall. Based on the results of those tests, which you record, you try to figure out which of the possibilities, and the possible ingredients are listed in a table in your manual. So based on the results of your test, you try to narrow it down to something that could agree with those test results. And then you tell me what you think is in A, B, and C, and I'll tell you whether you're right.
So you're going to do all the tests on the same 3?
Yes. Okay. Let's say you pick A2. You do Benedict's, Biuret, and IKI on A2. And you do the same thing with whichever B and whichever C. So 9 overall. Any questions on all of that? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and do it. Talk it out. Put on your goggles. As far as cleaning up today is concerned, don't pour volumes of anything down the sink other than pure water. There is a waste jug in here. Just empty your tubes. Now, once things are emptied, and especially like your dimple trays, you can still rinse them off in the sink and just quickly rinse them and then dry them. But the tubes themselves, once you empty them, just put them in the dirty test tubes bin over there. That's it.